Addressing the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to stoke sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's latest unemployment data showed a small improvement, but unemployment remains nearly 8%, at least officially. 5.9 million people remain unemployed, which is just a fraction less than the all-time high of 6.3 million in 2017. Back in September 2008, the total jobless numbered just 4.5 million. That means French unemployment has risen over 30% since the start of the Great Recession. With re-election just 6 months away, many say that Macron is running out of time to devote resources to the jobless or to devise a new system of accounting. Macron campaigned on a promise to bring unemployment under 7%.
His effort or his promise to increase employment by changing labor laws that would make France more attractive to foreign investors just hasn't worked. This idea of bringing in migrants for cheap labor to keep wages down is a real issue. So it's a big problem for Macron.
Under Macron's predecessor, François Hollande, the jobless rate increased 44 out of 46 months at one point. To change that, Hollande controversially started excluding part-time underemployed workers from the official count. Macron went one better and declared that just looking for work once in the past month no longer makes someone unemployed. Macron also began revealing jobless data only once every 3 months to avoid media discussion of the unpopular issue.
We have to really distinguish between what the official unemployment rate is and what the unofficial unemployment rate is. And if we take what the potential workforce is, it's much, much higher. And it's really amazing because the service sectors, like restaurants and bars and stores and stuff, can't find people to fill positions. And the reason is they don't pay enough.
For years, many French economists have said that the official unemployment rate is undercounted by a third, which would put the real unemployment rate at well over 20%. The Macron era had been one of constant economic unrest, but the coronavirus pause seems to have ended, with protests recently increasing in number and intensity. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and the children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
They're small in number, but they have big voices resonating along the streets of Oldham, Manchester, calling for Israeli arms company Elbit Systems to be shut down. This is the Elbit site in Manchester, and the event here organized by several pro-Palestinian groups who accuse Elbit of providing Israel with predatory drones and other military hardware, accusing it of complicity in Israeli war crimes and in abetting Israel in terrorizing the people of Gaza. Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of the Israel-based company of the same name, employs over 500 people and has 10 sites in the UK, including four factories.
Israel is an apartheid state. It's a racist state which is preventing Palestinians from living their ordinary everyday lives. And indeed worse, it's starving them, it's bombing them, it's killing them, it's depriving them of their lands and homes. And it has been since 1948. This factory here, Elbit, is the largest private Israeli arms factory. There's 10 outlets in the UK, and they are all making drones and weapons which go to kill Palestinians.
Apart from supplying Israel with weaponry, Elbit is also a major supplier of sophisticated technology to the British military.
That Britain and Israel have a clear, incestuous, revolving door type of relationship between each of their military establishments and their arms companies. We are fighting back against that here.
In August, pro-Palestine activists took their fight to another level. Direct action against the same site in Oldham, causing disruption to the firm's operations. For their actions, they often face intimidation, arrest, and possible prison time. But they say they're unfazed. Events such as the one today have led to increased public awareness about Elbit and its operations and growing calls for its closure. That, the activists say, is one important step towards a free Palestine.
Fear is growing in Indian-controlled Kashmir following a series of shooting incidents across the region that killed around a dozen civilians, including four non-local workers. The fear doubled among the non-local residents after police said non-locals should reach army camps and police stations. Dhananjit Kumar has been working in Kashmir for the last 12 years. Each year he stays here for 6 months and returns home with his hard-earned money. But this year he is moving ahead of time.
My family back home is worried. They insisted upon my return. I have worked for so many years here, but I have never seen such chaos. The situation here has never been right, but we were never involved. This time, it's different.
Dhananjit Kumar and many like him are on the move, while many others have sought police protection till they manage a way out. Following the deadly October violence in Kashmir that resulted in more than 33 killings, which included 9 Indian Army personnel, 11 civilians, and 13 pro-freedom fighters in different incidents, the administration issued an alert across the war-weary Indian-administered Kashmir. Intelligence reports warn of attacks on power projects, emergency landing strips, and other government infrastructure. New Delhi has installed additional security forces across Kashmir after intelligence reports warned of more attacks.
We are doing our best to neutralize the terrorists who are behind the civilian killings. We have killed around 11 terrorists in October till now, and we'll do our best to ensure the safety and security of our people. It's not a security lapse. The targets were soft, and now we beefed up and more vigilant.
After India stripped Kashmir's autonomous status in August 2019, people of the region were promised development, prosperity, and greater opportunities. However, media reports suggest the situation in the region has slipped from bad to worse due to the absence of local political activities and implementation of rules and laws without taking people of Kashmir on board. Kashmir is a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of Indian subcontinent in 1947. The two have fought wars over the territory and claimed the region in full, but rule it in parts.
The fresh spate of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir is seen by many as a politically motivated action. People of Kashmir urge the world community to help resolve this geopolitical dispute between India and Pakistan before they engage in war and devastate the leftover life. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Thank you.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashmi. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Saudi regime has once again shown that it has no tolerance for criticism of its policies. Lebanon's information minister criticized Riyadh for its war against Yemen. George Kodahi went on to say that Ansarullah has the right to defend the Yemeni nation against foreign aggressors who have killed Yemenis everywhere, from weddings to funerals, and many inside of their own homes. No place seems to have been safe in Yemen from Saudi bombardment. Despite these facts, Saudi Arabia wants to downgrade ties with Lebanon and is pressuring other Persian Gulf Arab countries to do the same. Stay with us as we take a look to see what all of this is really about on The Spotlight.
Saudi Arabia has ordered the Lebanese ambassador to the country to leave over what the kingdom refers to as offensive remarks by the Lebanese information minister regarding the ongoing war by Saudi-led coalition against Yemen. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a ban on all imports from Lebanon. At the same time, the Saudi Foreign Ministry has expressed regret over the deteriorating relations between Riyadh and Beirut, accusing Lebanon of ignorance and failure to take corrective measures to improve the bilateral ties between the two countries. All these came amid a call by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi for an end to the Saudi-sponsored war on Yemen, a devastating war with a simultaneous siege that have been killing and displacing Yemenis for more than 6 years now, a catastrophe that even the United Nations refers to as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Recently, the kingdom also classified a Beirut-based financial charity body as a terrorist entity, froze all the association's assets, and banned all sorts of financial transactions with it, all for the charity's ties with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. Lebanon-Saudi relations have been in free fall for years, but the kingdom's flagrant interference in Lebanon's internal affairs has intensified in the past few years. The highlight of that would be the unexpected resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri during a trip to Riyadh under Saudi degrading treatment and pressure. A year before that, Hariri had reached a power-sharing deal with Hezbollah and had attempted to convince Riyadh of the need to work with the resistance group. In 2016, Saudi Arabia halted $1 billion worth of aid to the Lebanese army, citing the country's regional ties. Those are followed by the latest series of Saudi sanctions against Lebanon, including the prohibition of its citizens from traveling to the country. However, Riyadh does not always act alone. Similar to its conduct in Yemen with regional allies and under Western support, it pressures some other Persian Gulf countries, sometimes through threats and sometimes through leverages, to fill in its footsteps. After controversy over Hariri's resignation, Kuwait and the UAE joined the kingdom to urge their citizens to leave Lebanon. The UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait all summoned their envoys in Lebanon in protest to the recent statements of the Lebanese information minister. In 2017, the very same group of countries, alongside Egypt, collectively severed their ties with Qatar, citing a variety of reasons, including support for terrorism or Qatar's backing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, allegations that were all strongly rejected by Doha.
I believe that people will raise their voices inside and outside Saudi Arabia, and they cannot win a war in which they kill people for speaking out their mind. This is they should stop this policy and come stop the war, stop the hooliganism, and stop the attacks on neighboring countries and on their own citizens. That's the best for everyone.
Therefore, one can say that the current Saudi measures against Lebanon, especially at the time of heightened economic instability and insecurity, would do nothing but deteriorate the already worsening crises in the Arab country.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, journalist and political analyst Safsa Kar Mostafa out of London. And author and researcher Denijal Yajic out of Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me on The Spotlight. I want to start it off in London. And Hafsa, why do you think Saudi Arabia has reacted in the way that it has from one politician criticizing it? I mean, it appears that probably if they had ignored this, it really wouldn't have been much of a story right now, since so many people across the world has actually criticized Saudi Arabia for its onslaught on Yemen.
Well, Saudi Arabia has proven itself to be quite a bully boy nation, and it feels that because it yields so much wealth, it can actually flex its muscle across the board. And it has decided to do that against Lebanon when Lebanon is at its weakest. So we already know that Lebanon has a very strong relation with Saudi Arabia in terms of finance and funding, and they are highly reliant on Saudi funds. And so this was a way for Saudi Arabia to sort of flex their muscle and show, here we're the boss, we'll tell you what you can do and what you can say. Obviously, I think it was particularly hurtful because the comment made by the Lebanese minister was obviously 100% truthful. It's particularly humiliating, of course, for Saudi Arabia because it's come from a Christian minister, given and reminding a Muslim nation that it's actually slaughtering and pounding a fellow Muslim nation. So I think the embarrassment was very strong here, and the Lebanese minister pressed a very sensitive button, hence the reaction. But again, I think this is not remotely surprising. First of all, because it's reminding Lebanon, that it has the financial means to flex its muscle. But also, I think this is very much in line with the policy that we've seen Saudi Arabia adopt over the past 10 years, at least since the start of the Arab Spring, which is to create division across the Arab world. Now, originally, many people had assumed that this was just a clumsy policy, just errors and failures to live up to its standards of Arab solidarity. But we're now seeing a pattern whereby Saudi Arabia plays a very deliberate role in destroying and creating division in the Arab world.
Okay.
It started obviously with Libya and Syria, and it's ongoing with Yemen.
All right, let me get our other guests in on this conversation. Your take, Dinajat, you heard what Hafsa said, that basically trying to punish Lebanon when it's basically at its weakest, the financing and the funding, and basically trying to teach a lesson, and also having a Christian minister to tell this so-called Muslim country how to treat its people. Tell me about this. Tell your perspective on what's going on here.
The other guest already said, we can see Saudi Arabia trying, I would say in a very desperate sort of way, to flex its muscles and to demonstrate the control that it has. And in many ways, what Saudi Arabia is trying to do, again, this is not the first time, is to expand its own oppressive regime in an extraterritorial manner onto Lebanon and other places in the region. And I think the current moment just really shows the what kind of an opposite Lebanon is to Saudi Arabia. Lebanon is a democracy with dozens of parties in the parliament and with vibrant political discussions, as opposed to Saudi Arabia, which is an oppressive regime that does not have a legitimate mandate from its own population. And now we have a situation where the Saudi regime is trying to punish Lebanon, and Lebanon's government, and particularly, I mean, effectively the whole country and everyone who lives here, just for the information minister basically saying that this war is futile and needs to end, which is something that many, you know, other politicians in the West have said, including in the United States, including allies and backers of Saudi Arabia. Whereas Saudi Arabia is really trying to show or demonstrate its power, it also comes from a perspective of desperation, I would say, because its role in the region is in decline, and it really necessitates violence, be that through control, coercion, or blackmailing beyond its borders, to keep its power alive.
Well, Hafsa, it seems that when it comes to Yemen, Riyadh has zero tolerance for criticism. I mean, how much do you think this is related to the fact that Saudi Arabia had expected to overpower the Yemenis very shortly after they initiated the war, and now the tables are turning, if not totally have turned, and the Yemenis are close to victory. Tell me about that side. How much is that related to it, that they are really reeling from near defeat now in Yemen?
I think that's very central to the argument because, of course, if you'll recall, when the war started back in 2015, they had initially said that it would be a two-week campaign. And obviously, 5 years on, the Houthis are still there. The tables, as you say, have turned, and the Saudis have suffered humiliating defeats. Bearing in mind that not only are the Houthis weaker in terms of the power struggle because Saudi Arabia has the support of many, many powerful countries, but of course it's actually invested billions in this conflict, and it hasn't really made any dent and impacted the war in any significant way other than being humiliated, other than massive losses on its side, and obviously other than dividing further the Arab world and creating a lot of bad press against it.
But then, John, the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait have also gone on board of trying to pressure Lebanon over this issue. Why?
Sorry, is this for me?
Beirut.
To be seen. I mean, the question is also, like, to what extent is Bahrain, sovereign? These are also, like Saudi Arabia, I mean, these are allies of Saudi Arabia, can be considered proxies of the United States in certain ways that are not necessarily having or following an individual foreign policy, but their decision-making is in many ways tied to Saudi Arabia, either through, as well, again, through control and influence. So there isn't really much of, so it just shows the to what extent the Saudi violence has expanded in the region for a while now. But effectively, I mean, this is, you know, it could really just be considered ridiculous in many ways. So again, just given that what the Lebanese minister said was literally that the war should stop, there should be peace. So, and then taking into consideration the proportion of this reaction and the way that it is being communicated from a political perspective, but also in the media, including the whole intimidation campaign that is ongoing, is just, you know, out of proportion, to say the least.
Well, Hafsa, I mean, when we see what is happening with the way Saudi Arabia has reacted, the way it has forced other Arab Persian Gulf states to basically follow suit, and at the end of the day, basically trying to pressure the Lebanese nation. I mean, this is a country that's part of the so-called Arab Union that's supposed to support Arab solidarity, and we see that it is willing to punish the Lebanese people. Do you think that this is going to make a difference, perhaps inside of Lebanon? Because Saudi Arabia has a lot of supporters inside of Lebanon. Will it make a difference? Do you think that they will see that this regime is willing to punish the Lebanese people to make a point?
I mean, this is a striking situation because they already know that they're hugely unpopular across the Arab world for their weak posture when it comes to the U.S., for their sort of meek position when it's come to Israel, for their involvement in various crises across the Arab world. And so perhaps Lebanon, or part of Lebanese opinion, was amongst the very few across the Arab world to sort of still have some form of relation and some form of affection, if you want, for Saudi Arabia, given its previous support financially of Lebanon. And yet now, obviously, this crisis, which is extraordinarily punitive against not only Lebanon, the government, but Lebanon as a country and therefore as for the people, I think they were going to lose the very little support they had left in the Arab world. But again, I mean, to reiterate the point, I think they no longer care about their position in the Arab world. And in fact, on the contrary, they're very much intent and they're going very hard in this position to actually go and destroy and divide ever further and in whatever means they can the Arab world just a little bit further. And I know what I'm going to say is going to sound slightly ironic, But I think that it's time that perhaps some governments, maybe the Syrian, maybe even the Lebanese, to start a motion to request that Saudi Arabia be expelled from the Arab League, because it has proven itself to be the absolute enemy of the Arab world and the Arab people.
Yeah, well, that would be quite a move, actually, to try to expel Saudi Arabia from the Arab League. But, Denichal, you know, we've seen time and time again Saudi Arabia interfering in Lebanon. And remember the incident with Saad Hariri years ago when he was basically made to resign while he was visiting Saudi Arabia. I mean, what does it say about the power that this foreign country has inside of Lebanon? And how complex does that make matters inside of Lebanon in order to try to resolve the current crises?
Has had a huge impact on Lebanon, particularly the past three decades, in different ways, sometimes more, sometimes less visible. But yeah, the incident you pointed to when Saad Hariri, who was prime minister of Lebanon on several occasions, and had several terms, who, you know, himself is a citizen of Saudi Arabia, who has lived there, and who has been loyal to the Saudi regime. And just him having had him as a prime minister, as such, is already, I think, one of the many examples of Saudi influence. And then when he was eventually arrested and, as some say, kidnapped and allegedly even tortured in Saudi Arabia in November 2017, exactly 4 years ago, and forced to resign live on television, it was just one of more visible events that have shown Saudi Arabia's actual power, but also its fear of losing power, because much of the Saudi investment in Lebanon is comes from a financial perspective. When we're talking about culture, society, there are not too many similarities. And in fact, Saudi Arabia isn't very popular in Lebanon when it comes to that, but it has been having a particular influence. And I think what we've seen yesterday and today in the local reactions in Lebanon has just re-emphasized that. We've seen a lot of celebrities, people in the media personalities, including activists or people who would consider themselves activists who promote progressive or human rights values, who have themselves condemned the Lebanese Minister of Information and have asked him to apologize, or have to Saudi Arabia, or even have asked him to resign. And this doesn't necessarily come out of an admiration for Saudi Arabia, but sometimes out of a maybe financial dependence. And the fact that Lebanon is, even though it has democratic structures unlike Saudi Arabia, is to a certain extent quite weak. So there's still a lot of influence that Saudi Arabia can have, but despite that, the support from within Lebanese parts of the Lebanese population for Saudi Arabia isn't necessarily based on admiration. And just one thing I also wanted to add, I mean, just 2 weeks ago we had this massacre in Beirut where at least 7 people were killed by a sniper shooting them from buildings, which were, as has been alleged, snipers of the Lebanese forces, which is a far-right Christian militia that is directly funded and supported by Saudi Arabia, and it has on several occasions tried to incite more conflict, chaos, and armed conflict within Lebanon, and is directly tied in Saudi Arabia's major proxy, if you want to say, in Lebanon. It's just another example of the of the very destructive role that Saudi Arabia plays internally.
And interestingly enough, Hafsa, Saudi foreign minister, talks about this crisis in Lebanon in general and says the origin of it all is Hezbollah dominance. Your take?
Yes, I think that plays a major role. I think for Saudi Arabia, Hezbollah's strength in Lebanon and its obvious ties to Iran remains a sore point for Saudi Arabia. And the fact that they haven't been able to pressure the Lebanese government and authorities to expel or to reduce the power of Hezbollah in Lebanon is something that sticks very strongly in the Saudi throat. And so they're finding any means possible to punish Lebanon because it remains faithful to Hezbollah and obviously respectful of its influence and its role in politics, which is obviously it sits in parliament and has a strong popular base across the populations. So this is a major reason, not the only one.
Well, perhaps let me just play devil's advocate here, because there would be Lebanese that say then that is the problem. Then if Hezbollah wasn't that influential, that they could live in peace.
Well, Hezbollah is influential because it has the support of a strong number of Lebanese people. I mean, it's not imposed on the Lebanese people. It's a movement that struggled, and then it's won its place in Lebanese society and Lebanese population through its role in politics, through its role in the struggle against the Israeli aggression, and of course, eventually in the polls. So it's a perfectly legitimate organization that is part of the fabric of Lebanon and has every right to sit and enjoy life in Lebanon as any other organization and any other movement that represents the fringe of the Lebanese population.
Well, Zanji, your take on that, because it just seems so unbelievably hypocritical of a Saudi politician talking about that the problems in general in Lebanon is because of Hezbollah, when the Saudis have been so involved in complicating the situation, as we can see with this current situation, and trying to put more pressure on the Lebanese people. Your take of all of this?
One could really, you know, ask the question hypothetically whether Lebanon would even exist today if it wasn't for the resistance efforts of Hezbollah. It has not only freed Lebanon from the Zionist occupation, but has also continues to defend Lebanon against the Zionist infiltrations, as well as the terrorist groups that were trying to infiltrate through Syria for many years. So Hezbollah does guarantee the sovereignty of Lebanon. And this is, again, something that we've seen today. There are three parties in the parliament that have condemned the attacks against the Minister of Information. And one of those three parties was Hezbollah, whereas the majority of the other parties was either asking him to apologize or condemning him. So in many ways, Hezbollah guarantees the sovereignty and the independence of Lebanon, and also guarantees the sovereignty and independence of those in Lebanon who oppose Hezbollah. But this is, of course, something that might be too complex to understand if we are, you know, coming from a Saudi perspective that is based on coercion and violence. And again, what I also find very, very dangerous at this point is the amount of conspiracy theories that there are. Particularly in Lebanon, there are, I think we see from, there are opponents, there are some opponents of Hezbollah rather than critics. There's less legitimate criticism, I would say, that we hear, but more outright opposition because of ideological or sectarian reasons. And then oftentimes there's this sort of narrative conspiracy theory, I would say, of an alleged Iranian occupation. This is, of course, a minority that is peddling this discourse, but it happens, it gets brought up every once in a while whenever there is such a tension as was taking place since yesterday. And it is, of course, completely ridiculous and ahistorical, and also whitewashes the violent role that Saudi Arabia has had, because Saudi Arabia is effectively more or less aligned with the Zionist regime that is actively trying to undermine Lebanon's sovereignty. It was just one of the many problems here.
Hafsa, where do you see all of this going? Do you think that divide is going to continue and even widen now between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon? Or your analysis of this overall situation at this point?
It's very difficult to say, because obviously Lebanon is at a very, very weak point. And therefore, I mean, they've obviously tried to rectify the situation and sort of appease the Saudis in whatever way they can. Saudi Arabia, being the bully boy that it is, will obviously kick somebody, especially when they're down. Obviously, they never stand up to the U.S. They would never stand up to any Western country whatsoever. But they can easily stand up to Lebanon, which is a small country, which is a resourceless country, and which is at the moment in a very, very weak spot. So I'm assuming that they're going to perhaps exert more pressure. And I think the Lebanese are going to try and find some sort of compromise at some point. Hopefully they won't compromise too much, because, of course, if they do that further, then they can only make the situation worse because of the next crisis. Who knows what the Saudis are going to expect?
Danja, 30 seconds. Let me get Danja in here. 30 seconds. Same question.
Yeah, I agree. I think Saudi Arabia is weakened and is just trying to bully Lebanon. This is not the first time, and I think, you know, effectively Lebanon will prevail. I mean, despite this crisis and everything, there is going to be a way to move forward. Lebanon is part of the axis of resistance and has produced the strongest non-state actor, one of the strongest militaries, which is Hezbollah in the region, and it just shows the resilience of the resistance, which continues.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Hafsa Karat Mustafa out of London, researcher out of Beirut, Denijel Yancek. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At Falono Society for Deaf Children in Gaza City conducted a survey of 102 people shortly after a ceasefire brought an end to Israeli regime's bombardment in May. More than 84% of those surveyed had a disability. More than 38% of respondents replied that their homes were slightly damaged. Another 8% stated that the damage to their homes was severe. Almost 19% replied that their movements were curtailed during the attack and they could not fulfill their basic needs as a result. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Rovaida Omer Ryder. This article is titled Zionist Regime Puts Gaza's Deaf People in Extreme Danger. Stay tuned for more. Mahmoud Abu Namous has just become a father for the first time. His daughter was born in September following an extremely stressful pregnancy. The worst stress was during the 11 days when the Zionist regime carried out a major attack against Gaza in May. Mahmoud is deaf. His wife, Fatima Zahir, had to remind him regularly that he should stay away from windows in their Gaza City home during those dangerous days. He had to confine himself within those parts of their home where he would be less vulnerable as explosions occurred. Mahmoud shared Fatima's fear each time she heard a blast. He said, "I could sense it from her facial expressions. The attack brought back painful memories." Mahmoud and his family were uprooted from their home during a previous Zionist offensive in the summer of 2014. Mahmoud was preparing for his high school exams at that time. He recalls being so frustrated and tired that his mother's warning to leave their home immediately barely registered with him. The family's home was destroyed after they evacuated. Lacking adequate support, some deaf people went to considerable lengths to be properly informed about what was happening in May of this year. TV stations generally did not show sign language interpreters on a screen during news programs. Mahmoud tried to fill the gap by gathering what information he could find and making sign language videos of his own. He posted those videos on Instagram so that other deaf people in Gaza could watch them. Both Saida Miqdad and her husband, Zedine, are deaf. During the May attack, Saida said, "I felt that I was in terrible danger whenever the house shook, but I did not know where the bombs were landing." Saida lives in Gaza City, but has family in Khan Yunis area of southern Gaza. She said, "They understand sign language, so I could communicate with them by video during the attack. But the connection was unreliable because of electricity cuts and because we only had internet access some of the time." Heba Abu Jazar is a deaf community activist living in Rafah near Gaza's border with Egypt. She recalled how members of her family were constantly telling us to be careful during the May attack. She said, "When there was shelling near my house, we were able to escape to my uncle's place because it was safer. I was very afraid because I could not hear what was happening." In the early stages of the attack, she and her sisters viewed photos and videos of atrocities on the internet. She said, "That made us feel even more afraid and anxious, so we decided to stay away from the news. It was only a temporary solution, but it gave us a bit more courage to keep going." The Asfaluna Society for Deaf Children in Gaza City conducted a survey of 102 people shortly after a ceasefire brought an end to the Zionist regime's bombardment in May. More than 84% of those surveyed had a disability. More than 38% of respondents replied that their homes were slightly damaged. Another 8% stated that the damage to their homes was severe. Almost 19% replied that their movements were curtailed during the attack and they could not fulfill their basic needs as a result. Umayya Health, a sign language teacher, spent most of the 11 days during which Gaza was attacked to provide deaf people with emotional support. Deaf people, she explained, constantly feel that they are marginalized by society. That sense of marginalization exacerbated the fears of many deaf people in May. Most of the deaf people in Gaza are unemployed, Health added. There are many jobs they could do, but because they are deaf, they are rarely accepted. This is not good. It makes them feel frustrated and lose hope. An additional problem is that deaf people have in many cases not received counseling since the attack. Ellis said, "Psychologists and social workers must learn sign language so that they can run support sessions for people with hearing disabilities." Nagla Mahmoud is a mother of 6 children living in Khan Yunis. As Nagla is deaf, she relied on her 11-year-old daughter Shams to explain in sign language what was happening during the May offensive. Nagla said, "It was very difficult because my children were screaming from the sounds of the missiles.
I tried to stay beside them all the time, to hug and hold them. I often sat crying in fear, but my husband always reassured me that the attack would end and we would survive.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.